The area upon which Umpqua Watershed is located was formerly occupied by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquel, Malala, and others, some of whom still inhabit the land. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity toward the natural environment, which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement.
Welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Casey Hovig, Executive Director of Umpqua Watersheds, and joining me today are Angela Jensen, Umpqua Watersheds Conservation and Legal Director, and Ryan Kincaid, Umpqua Watersheds Director of Education and Outreach. In this episode, we are excited to announce a format change to the show. Going forward, we will continue to have our alternating episodes hosted by our AmeriCorps Environmental Education and Outreach Leader, Viviana Young, which features interviews with people on various topics. On alternating weeks, we'll be hosting shows focused on climate change and diversity, equity, and inclusion. Two topics which are vital to our community and our planet and a natural fit for Living Downstream show. Our discussion today will be focused on Umpqua Watershed's goals for addressing climate change in 2022 and our strategic alliances with other organizations focused on climate change. But first, let's talk about our own interests and backgrounds and why each of us are so passionate and determined to make a difference in the movement to address climate change. Let's start with Angela. Please tell us a little about yourself and how you first learned about climate change.
Thank you, Casey. I am originally from Southern Oregon, and I suppose I'm always going to call it home. I grew up in the Illinois Valley. This is south and west of Grants Pass. If you take Highway 199 toward the coast, it's a very beautiful area. And as a child and young adult, I grew up riding my horse on old logging roads and swimming in the creeks and rivers, and also working in the local wine grape vineyards. It was a fabulous way to grow up. I loved it there, but I first learned about climate change by simply being curious about the changes that I was seeing in our area with regard to snowpack changes and stream flows that were changing in our valley. It was also easy to see changes in the vineyards because, you know, bud break was starting to happen earlier than we had expected. And, you know, the plants wouldn't slip into dormancy until later than we anticipated. So those things were definitely evident to me. But I think I really started learning about climate change after watching Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. And there was so much negative pushback regarding the claims that he made in that film that, you know, I started researching everything for myself and reading up on the science and the projected impacts of climate change. And it was at this point that I became so alarmed that I wanted to find a way to affect positive change regarding climate change. And then I, of course, pursued my master's in environmental law and policy with a focus on climate change mitigation and adaptation. In fact, that's where I met you, Casey, because we have the same degree there. It was excellent, excellent learning together. For me, I cannot see climate change as a standalone issue. Mitigating climate change and adapting to climate change are dual goals for sure, but they definitely overlap with each other and with conservation efforts generally. And this is why our conservation committee at Umpqua Watersheds considers climate change as an extremely vital topic. Our efforts in conservation focus, of course, on the conservation and preservation of our forests, our waters, and our ecosystems. And these efforts, of course, are imperative and necessary for climate change mitigation, but they are, you know, just as important to adaptation because our local ecosystems and their services that they provide us are going to have a much better chance of adapting to the coming changes if we properly conserve and protect from degradation and exploitation. So next, I guess we're just going to move on to Ryan, our education and outreach director.
Yes, hi. So I'm Umpqua Watersheds Director of Education and Outreach, and I'm from the Finger Lakes region of New York State, actually. But I spent time in Oregon this past year when I served as the AmeriCorps member with Umpqua Watersheds. And I loved the beauty of the Umpqua Watershed region, and I'm excited to be able to continue working for the organization remotely. I chair both the Education and Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committees. I'm excited that we're putting together a monthly climate change episode on Living Downstream, because climate change is such an important topic, yet people don't really understand its complexities or the far-reaching implications if we continue on our current trajectory. Climate change has so much to do with education. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about climate change, and people need access to high-quality scientific information wherever they get their information, whether it be the newspaper, the radio, email, Facebook, or other electronic media, etc. In addition to the radio show, one of the things that our Climate Change Task Force will be doing is partnering with the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition to offer monthly educational events, panels, film screenings, and the like, to help the public learn about climate change. Also, something we'll be diving into is the disproportional impact of climate change on BIPOC, or Black and Indigenous people of color, and low-income communities. So often, environmental degradation goes hand in hand with oppression and injustice toward already marginalized people. And so something that's kind of interesting is I taught middle school science for 5 years. And I also led after school programs, did all sorts of programs with youths. But I didn't really learn about climate change in school at all. And I feel like I got a pretty good education. But then also too, thinking about the teaching that I did, and I was trying to be as informed as I could. You know, I majored in environmental studies when I went to college. And I tried to incorporate different information about climate change into my teaching, and yet there's so much that I didn't include. So I feel that, you know, I'm always wanting to learn more, and I know that everyone else can be learning more as well. So at this time, I'll pass it over to Casey, our executive director.
Thank you, Angela and Ryan. I appreciate your insights and very excited to be working with you on this new show. I remember back in the 80s, reading an article when I lived down in the Ozarks of Missouri, and it said a murky forecast for the atmosphere, and it was because of smog. And of course, at that time, we always were thinking the greatest threat was smog and pollution, and then eventually the ozone depletion and of that. And so we knew that at that time that there were major consequences of industrialization, and had seen that. But I remember in the 90s reading an article from Popular Mechanics magazines that talked about, it was from 1910, and it talked about the impact of coal would have on creating a warming condition on the planet because of that impact. So they knew way back then that this concept of global warming and the cause was related to carbon, burning of carbon in the atmosphere. Of course, no one at that time could foresee what jet planes and deforestation with the huge logging equipment and automobiles. I always think the highways are like rivers of carbon that are just floating by when you're on a highway and thinking about that. So I was really interested at a fairly young age of what was happening to the planet because of the carbon. I remember when I first got involved in the nonprofit world was like in 2008, and I was involved in a movement to address hunger, global hunger. I'd worked with a group of Ethiopian people who had immigrated to the United States and were sending money back and trying to find sustainable solutions to small villages in Ethiopia and where people were starving. And at that time, we started hearing more about climate change. And I always thought about, wow, you know, this climate change is having a huge impact on the planet and will have a progressing impact. But where it's going to hurt people the most are people who don't have anything, that who can't get in their car and move, who can't sell their house and move to a more desirable location. It's those people in already desperate situations that are going to be impacted. So back in 2014, I believe it was, I enrolled in the Vermont Law Program for Environmental Law and Policy. And that's when, as Angela mentioned, I met her. And both of us chose climate change as our emphasis to study about that. And what's shocking to me is that at the time, everything that we're reading and studying was telling us you probably aren't going to see these dramatic effects for many years to come, but it's something that is building and building, and it will, unless we address it now, it'll reach a point of no return. But what's shocking is that we are obviously seeing the impact of climate change less than 10 years from when we were in that program, and it seems to be progressing. It'd be interesting to see what happens the next 5 to 10 years as we're more aware of it. I saw an interview with Al Gore today, and he is actually feeling somewhat optimistic because of the attention that the global warming is having and climate change is having, and how people are gathering together to do something about climate change. And I have to agree with that because of a coalition that we're involved in, along with the Douglas County Global Warming Alliance, who have inspired me since I've been in Oregon for the past 10 years, of the work they're doing on the ground. Stuart Leibowitz and his crew have just done a remarkable job with very little resources to draw attention to the topic of climate change. This past year, Umpqua Watersheds became part of an alliance called Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance. It's an organization of 72 different nonprofits that are scattered across Oregon, working together to come up with policy recommendations for state and federal government, and working with them create a better understanding in our communities of the challenges of climate change and what we can do about it. So I'm really excited that this new radio show that we're going to be hosting on a monthly basis will give those folks an opportunity to talk about what they're doing and to give people hope that these coalitions can come together and make a positive difference for the planet. We've seen so much just in the last 18 months that we've been able to do. So there is hope. I do agree with Al Gore on that, that we can and are making progress on that. So let's talk a little bit more about what is climate change. Let's talk about the basics of climate change. Angela, can you tell us what is climate change?
Absolutely. But first, I want to echo your sentiment that regarding climate change, there is hope. And we shouldn't forget that as I move forward in this part of the discussion. And I agree with you and Al Gore on that most certainly. To answer your question, in a nutshell, climate change is a change or a shift in our climate patterns, largely caused by greenhouse gas emissions from the burning of fossil fuels. Climate change is often referred to as global warming, but this gets confusing because people end up expecting this to mean that our weather will continue to warm and that our temperatures are just going to continue to rise on any given day. And so it's important that when we talk about climate change, we separate climate change from weather. Weather is definitely impacted by the shifting in the climate, but just because you're seeing little changes in the weather, you can't really say, oh, that's climate change. So it's important to realize that while our weather is affected by climate change, there is a difference here. So we're talking about a shift in the global and local and regional climate, not just your everyday weather. While it's true that, you know, throughout geologic time, there have been shifts in climate patterns, the shift we're seeing and talking about now most definitely correlates with the rise in greenhouse gas emissions as marked by the industrial age. And here's why. So this is just the basics as to why we see this shift and why we're seeing increased temperatures, surface temperatures, is because basically called the greenhouse gas effect or the greenhouse effect. Electromagnetic radiation from the sun, warms the Earth's surface, and without our atmosphere, much of this heat would be, in fact, lost. It would escape back out into space. But within our atmosphere, we have molecules of various gases, and these are, by and large, greenhouse gases, which are composed of carbon dioxide, fewer than carbon dioxide is methane, and the most predominant molecule is actually water vapor. And these molecules will actually absorb the radiation and reflect it back to Earth. And this is why we actually have a warm, habitable planet, because if we didn't have these heat-trapping molecules, then and all of this energy and heat would end up back in space, basically our Earth's surface would be a negative 18 degrees Celsius or 0 degrees Fahrenheit. It would not be habitable at all. So this is what's called the greenhouse gas effect. Now, the problem rises now because the concentration of these greenhouse gases, and primarily we say carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide equivalents because they are all greenhouse gases, and then we measure them in equivalents when we speak about concentration. The concentration has steadily increased since the industrial age, largely because of our burning of fossil fuels, but other anthropogenic reasons as well, or human-caused actions. The concentration has historically fluctuated somewhere between 200 and 300 parts per million, but my last research on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration site shows that that part per million is now more than 415, so that concentration is alarming. It's very alarming, especially since the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and over 2,000 scientists that contribute to that have said that if we're going to keep our climate in a workable pattern and have it not kind of go off the rails, we really need to keep it around 350. Well, we are well above that part per million. And so with this heightened concentration of greenhouse gas molecules, it's holding in the heat and trapping more of the radiation. And this is ultimately causing the shift in our climate and warming the Earth's surface. And that's basically causing the shift. And so now that's basically climate change and what we're talking about here today.
Thanks, Angela. So thinking about this current shift in climate, what are some of the human activities that are contributing to the changes that we're seeing now, and how do they differ from those geologic and global changes that happened, you know, millions of years ago?
Sure. So I like to think of and look at the contributing factors to climate change and the increased concentration of the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing climate change. I like to look at graphs nationally, what's happening nationally, as well as what's happening globally. And, you know, nationally, it's by and large, the emissions are coming from the electricity and power sector. So this goes back to what we talked about earlier about the burning of fossil fuels. But second is actually transportation. And, you know, our transportation sector burns a lot of fossil fuels, and not just because all of us are driving cars, but, you know, when we're all traveling every day by plane, by bus, doesn't matter, the transportation sector and the burning of fossil fuels through gasoline and such is another huge contributor. And it's important to realize that, you know, when the Kyoto Protocol was being drafted and George Bush was president, George W. Bush was president at the time, we were going to sign on to that to reduce our carbon footprint. And I'm just going to talk about this briefly based on transportation, because President Bush said then, and this is why we ended up not being a signatory to the Kyoto Protocol, which would have committed us to reducing our carbon footprint, is because he said the American way of life is not up for sale and it's not up for negotiation. That's actually what he said, is not up for negotiation. And basically what he was referring to is this is the way we live. You know, our transportation sector, our freedom to move via transportation and the energy that we consume in this sector as well as others and in industry. And in industry is actually third in line as the most human-caused activity of, you know, contributing to greenhouse gas emissions. But he said then that the American way of life is not up for negotiation, and that's why we didn't sign on to that. So Anyway, those are the three top nationally rated contributors to greenhouse gas emissions and to climate change. The fourth is agriculture and forestry. Now, that's nationally. So, but what I want to talk about also is that changes when you look at the regional and global, but I want to talk about our region, that graph, because the truth is that in Oregon, the top contributor is still electricity and the power sector, but believe it or not, forestry and agriculture combined make up 40% of the greenhouse gas emissions in our region, and 30 of that 40% comes from forestry. And that's important to note. And the reason I bring that up is because I'm the conservation chair and we work hard in conservation here at On-Call Watersheds. And every time an established forest ecosystem is removed by logging, not only are we emitting these carbon, contributing to carbon emissions, but we're also losing the capacity to store and sequester carbon. And this is critical to mitigating climate change. So those are the four top human activities that are contributing to climate change. But it's also important to note that, our everyday consumption and the energy that is used just in the basics of packaging and transportation with getting goods from one place to the other, all of our human activities are contributing every day. And that's something that we need to be mindful of.
Thanks, Angela. That's very, very interesting and certainly understandable how human activities are contributing to climate change, given the explosive growth of the human population. And then just within the last 100, 150 years, all the different machines and all of them burning carbon have added to carbon to the atmosphere. If you think about all the planes and all the cars and all the trains and all the activity going on, and how, if you look at our planet and see the lights that are on all over the world, what an amazing transformation humans have had on the planet. And it's kind of ridiculous to think that, oh, well, we need to continue with our way of life, the American way of life, as Bush called it, but knowing what it's doing to this beautiful planet, that we're seeing the rise of carbon in the atmosphere that hasn't been seen for millions and millions of years. And we've done it only in the span of a couple hundred years. That's crazy. Right. Yeah, can you tell us a little about some of the effects we're already seeing because of climate change?
Sure. So on that, let's looking at it again on a global scale, we're already seeing extreme weather events. We're seeing, our hurricanes becoming more severe, more frequent, other weather events just becoming more extreme. And this is exactly what the IPCC predicted, that there will be shifts in the weather, but what it's going to be is that dry conditions will become drier, wet conditions may become wetter. Basically, what it means is that what was predicted is that you're going to see a shift toward extremes. And so you're going to have more frequent weather events, and they're going to be more extreme. And we are certainly seeing that. We're also seeing the loss of global ice, in particular in the Arctic, sea ice in particular. But we're also seeing sea level rise. And that's because of the loss of sea ice, of course. But then bringing it home to Oregon here, we're seeing drier conditions. On average, we're seeing drier conditions all across the board here, in our forests, in our waters. We have, the what we talk about a lot in conservation is low flow. And that's because our streams and our rivers and our water levels, they're not really what they used to be. And they're not able to recover from drought conditions as readily as they used to be. And that's an effect that we've been seeing. I remember seeing it in particular in the vineyard. And we had, in one case, we had a small creek that ran through the vineyard. And every year, it just seemed like it kept drying earlier and earlier. And one year in particular, I went there and it was I believe it was it was early spring, and there were pools of water and that where normally it should have been running, and there were little coho salmon fingerlings that were stuck there, and I ended up, you know, rescuing them because they couldn't make it out to the river like they normally would have. And so we're definitely seeing, you know, low flow effects in the water, in our water levels. The other thing that we're seeing is an extended fire season. So now in Oregon, our fire season basically begins almost a whole month earlier than it has historically, and how that we would normally predict it to happen. It's also ending later. So now we see fire season extending, you know, well into the fall, and the dry conditions not recovering until, you know, late fall, if they do. And a lot of this also can be seen because of our decreased snowpack. So when I talk about low flow and that our waterways are not able to recover from drought conditions, this is also evident because of the shift in the climate that's happening that is producing less snow. And the snowpack that we are getting on our mountains, which would normally, you know, hold the water that would replenish us throughout the warmer seasons, that snow is coming later and it's not as much and it's melting earlier. So we don't have that reserve, if you will. And I remember seeing that growing up in the Illinois Valley. I would be working in the vineyards, and every winter I remember being able to look up on Grayback Mountain and Kirby Peak and see a snowpack. And we would often bet, like, hey, will there still be snow come July 4th? Because that wasn't uncommon. Now we have winters where you don't see snow. And if you do, it's gone by March. And this has now become not an anomaly, but it's become the norm. And so, yes, we're definitely seeing the effects even locally.
Yes, indeed. I agree. Just the extreme weather events, whether it's tornadoes or hurricanes or fires caused by Santa Ana winds in the Umpqua, as we saw Archie Creek in fire in 2020, there's evidence all around us that these extreme things are happening.
Yeah, I remember seeing the intense drought conditions just last spring when I was out in the Roseburg area. In March, it was as dry as it usually was in late summer, based on what people who have lived there for decades have noticed. So it's no surprise, although quite unfortunate, that we then had devastating fires again in the fall of 2021, following the so-called 100-year fire that we had, or fires that we had in 2020, just the year before. Without mitigation, what can we expect to see going forward?
I think without a doubt, we can expect to see more of the same, unfortunately. And, you know, again, extremes are going to become more extreme. But one thing to add to this is we're going to see migrations. We're going to see migrations of plant and animal species to higher elevations and moving toward the poles to cooler temperatures. And, you know, that's been predicted, it's already happening. But globally, you're also going to, well, and I should say that even nationally, you're going to probably see a migration of people, you know, away from low-lying coastal areas, away from fire-prone areas. I think we've already seen that from the devastation that happened in California in the past couple of years. And, you know, people are going to move away from what is no longer habitable. And this is also happening globally. So when you have low-lying islands, you know, you have people that are actually losing their islands, they're losing their homes. And so there are climate migrations already taking place. And these are more in line with, you know, I want to talk about this a little bit because you brought up how this is also a social justice issue. And it is, because it's the people that don't have the wherewithal. And a lot of times it's indigenous or communities, especially in these low-lying islands, that, you know, they don't have the wherewithal to build resilience against climate change and to take care of themselves with the effects that are happening to them, especially with sea level rise. And so they leave and they have no choice. And it's unfortunate, and but that's definitely happening on the global scale, most definitely. And these types of things will continue to happen. Absolutely.
Boy, it's a daunting problem just to understand because of all the systems involved in trying to figure out how do we get out of this mess. I think most of us at one time or another lie awake at night and think, well, what's the future like when we've seen so much happen just mm-hmm. in our own life? What can we do? Do individual actions even matter? Are we beyond that point?
Yeah, it's when you think about it, it feels daunting because this is a global issue. It's a global problem. So it's going to take global effort. And it's easy to feel like as a single individual, my effort doesn't matter because so what if I do my best to decrease my carbon footprint or my emissions? You know, if nobody else does their fair share, then what does it matter? This is part of the tragedy of the commons. It takes all of us. That is absolutely true. But I still want to circle back to one of the first things you said and that you cited Al Gore. There is hope. There is a movement now. People are more aware. There is better understanding and people are more willing to get educated on the topic and find out what they can do as an individual. And there really is something you can do as an individual just to decrease your own carbon footprint. And people are taking these steps every day across the nation, across the globe, and they matter. And some of these steps really do include, you know, be mindful of your transportation use. Be mindful of how much electricity you're consuming. Take steps to decrease less, or excuse me, to consume less. Be mindful of where you buy your food. There are a lot of, I understand, you know, there's a, you know, an issue about understanding what is organic food and all of that, but there are farmers out there that are taking steps to engage in what is called climate smart agriculture. So they're tilling less, they're using less water. And, you know, a lot of that comes or is happening at home. Okay. So look out for your local farmers and find out how they're producing food and support them. A lot of it comes down to our consumption, our use of electricity, our use of transportation, and just being mindful of our everyday actions. I know that conserving our resources, you know, if you own land, forestry land, please conserve it. Conserve it for the wildlife. Conserve it for carbon sequestration capacity. If you work in agriculture, if you own a farm, use climate smart agriculture. Till less and plant drought resistant crops. As an individual going to work, if you're able to walk or cycle, don't drive, you know, or drive less. You know, a lot of that could be weather dependent, but there are always things that we can do. And certainly what I'm speaking about here is not an exhaustive list. We will be putting together our website on Umpqua Watersheds that we talk a little more about all of this. And we will definitely be providing an extensive list there, especially oriented toward our community here in Douglas County.
As I mentioned earlier, our local, one of the first groups that really got together and wanted to do something to impact the community regarding climate change is Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. Stuart Leibowitz is a champion, someone who's inspired me for so long because he's tireless and what he and Polly are doing to energize people to make a stand. And it to me, he's a good example of someone all on his own, along with his group, Polly Sterling and our Melanie McKinnon, who's on the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition board, that these people have been working on this for years and years, long before it was a major community outside our community. Of course, it's been talking about since Al Gore talked about it, but they've been really working tirelessly, showing up at events and educating people. So Ryan, what do you think about that? And is, don't you think that's a way that Umpqua Watersheds can really help engage people?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, back even before my days as a teacher, as an educator, I've always felt that education is so important. And our organization, Umpqua Watersheds, is committed to helping ensure that the information is out there, that the facts are available. Yeah, education is just so important. And as more people at the individual level and then at the broader community level get informed and are knowledgeable and start to make those changes, we can have a greater impact collectively. So I'm really excited about this show and these episodes that we'll have through Living Downstream. It's been very interesting to see the transformations through Living Downstream and all the different experts that we've had in different fields. And now we're going to expand that even more and just try to get this information out there so that people know what differences and what changes they can make and start to make those changes.
And I just want to tie on to that real quick, Ryan, because, you know, you're absolutely right. Education is so important. The community and public involvement is an amazing way to move forward. And so what I just want to say here also is, you know, encourage people to, I just want to encourage everybody to get involved. You know, you want to get involved with Umpqua Watersheds or some of these other environmental groups and coalitions that are focusing on this, create your own group. But, you know, build a movement and help us build the movement for awareness and for change. And what comes hand in hand with that is to speak up to your representatives, speak up to the governmental associates, our governor, our senators, our representatives, even our president, because that's where the real change is going to happen when it comes to regulating industry, regulating the transportation and power sectors. Because when it, you know, those are the daunting tasks, but that's why we have the system that we have, so that we can, as individuals in this democracy, we can speak up and encourage change on the regulatory level on from the government, from that standpoint. So I encourage everybody to speak up and to build movements and to be a part of movement and work with others so that our voices are heard to move this change forward.
Absolutely. And I want to circle back to the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance that we talked about earlier and how important these groups of 72 disparate organizations across the state working together to come up with a cohesive message to our legislators and to our communities on what can be done. The Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, or the Alliance, comes together with the understanding that in order to protect forests and meaningfully address the climate crisis, we must transform the extractivist culture to achieve sustainable and just societies. And we believe forest defense is community defense. We work together in the defense of the Pacific Northwest communities and ecosystems as we recognize their health and well-being are fundamentally interconnected. Forest defense is climate defense. Our work is driven by the important role forests play in mitigating the climate crisis and creating climate-resilient communities. Solidarity with frontline communities. We support action taken by Black, Indigenous, people of color, and other frontline communities to combat the climate crisis. We take guidance from traditional land stewards to inform our advocacy. Transformation, not reformation. We work to transform, not reform, the imbalanced and unfair systems that drive the destruction of forests and forest-dependent communities, both human and non-human. This will require a shift away from industrial logging. We embrace real solutions. We reject unproven and dangerous practices that distract and misdirect resources from real solutions. Effective and enduring solutions will come from a fundamental transformation away from the extractive systems that have brought us to disaster. Must end corporate exploitation. We must end ecologically destructive logging, restore landscapes, and protect ecologically significant places. And finally, we must advance a just transition. We support workers in rural communities in a just transition toward a life-affirming economy. That's really powerful, a really powerful statement. And if you want to read it, if you just go to forestclimate.org, you can see what's going on. And we're a local representative of this alliance, and we want you to get involved both with the alliance and with Umpqua Watersheds.
Yeah, just before we wrap up this episode, I'd also like to take the opportunity to just invite our listeners to attend our monthly educational events that we're going to be offering so they can learn more about climate change. It'll take place on Friday, February 11th, starting at 5 p.m. Pacific time. We'll have a virtual panel discussion focusing on the impacts of climate change on Pacific Northwest wildlife. We've got a great lineup of various experts who are eager to share their expertise on this topic, and I'm really excited to get going on these monthly educational events.
Thanks, Ryan and Angela. Let's take a quick break and continue our discussion about climate change when we get back.
Climate change has far-reaching impacts for humans and non-human species alike. To explore some of the effects that global shifts in temperature, precipitation, and natural disasters are having on wildlife of the Pacific Northwest, Umpqua Watersheds and the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition are teaming up with local experts for a panel discussion which will take place Friday, February 11th at 5 p.m. Pacific Time. To join us for this virtual event, please email Umpqua Watersheds Director of Education and Outreach at ryan@umpquawatersheds.org, that's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org, to sign up and receive the Zoom link.
Hi, this is Casey Hovick, Executive Director with Umpqua Watersheds.
And I am Ryan Kincaid, Umpqua Watersheds Director of Education and Outreach, as well as the Chair of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee.
Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute.
We are excited to utilize our radio station, KQUA, as a platform for marginalized voices. If you are interested in hosting a radio program honoring diverse perspectives and elevating those who have been oppressed, please email your idea to ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. That's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org.
99.7 KQUA LP Roseburg, a community service of Umpqua Watersheds. Umpqua Watersheds is dedicated to the protection and restoration of the ecosystems of the Umpqua Watersheds and beyond through education, training, advocacy, and ecologically sound stewardship. More information at umpquawatersheds.org and on Facebook.
Hi, this is Janice, host of Earth in Tune, every Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 4 p.m. right here on 99.7 KQUA. The show features music that mentions something about Earth or nature. This coming weekend, January 22nd and 23rd, 2022, I will have a special guest to introduce her own song. Artist Marilyn Jordan will be here on the show to give you insight into her song, River Water. I hope you can join us.
Thanks, Janice. I can't tell you how much we appreciate listening to Earth in Tune every Saturday and Sunday. Now let's return to living downstream. So, Angela, why is it so difficult to address the problem of climate change and get people to understand what an incredible challenge this is for everyone on the planet?
So I just wanted to talk about this a bit. You know, the truth is we live in a capitalistic system. It takes money to make money, and it takes consumerism to keep the wealth flowing to those who already have the power and the money to keep their wealth intact and growing. So as we have already mentioned, most of the emissions contributing to climate change come from the electricity sector, transportation sector, and industry. But in our region, logging ranks right up there among them. But it still comes down to consumerism because that is what drives the economy. And again, as Bush declared, as our reason for not signing onto the Kyoto Protocol, the American way of life is not up for negotiation. And so we have a small but very wealthy and powerful segment of our population that are more interested in protecting their wealth and the future growth of their wealth than the welfare of our planet and the general population. So here's an example. The science of climate change has been sound for decades, even if the full effects have been a bit uncertain. In the late 70s and early 80s, James Hansen of NASA, having recognized the effects of increased greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, he focused his research on the subject and even testified before congressional committees to raise awareness on the issue. But obviously, this didn't get us anywhere because we are still divided on this issue today. And one of the biggest reasons why is because of what I like to call the corporate denial machine. And Exxon is a great example. In July of 1977, Exxon's own scientists knew of the science and potential effects of increasing greenhouse gas emissions into our atmosphere. In fact, their senior scientist, James Black, warned that doubling CO2 emissions into the atmosphere would produce a significant rise in our surface temperatures and that there would be fallout from that. This was a warning. But of course, curtailing emissions from such a producer is contrary to the American way of life. As I said, our economy thrives on consumerism and, of course, the use of fossil fuels. So all the corporate denial machine, and in this case, Exxon, had to do was plant a seed of doubt in the mind of the American public and, you know, basically to protect their interest in wealth produced by fossil fuel extraction and consumption. And all they had to do, you know, they didn't need to disprove the science already apparent and documented. They simply needed to find a way to make the general public and our legislative representatives question the science and its outcome. And they did a good job of this. All they had to do was disseminate was the concept that the science was inconclusive and the effect of increased emissions could not be stated with complete certainty. And of course, this is easy for the American consumer to swallow because it negates the need for change. So this is all industry needed to do to keep going. And we'll dive deeper into this on our webpage as well as future shows, I'm sure. But this is why we need education along with our conservation efforts. The first step to solving any problem is recognizing that there is one, and that is difficult for many of us. So many of us cannot fathom a change in the American way of life, so to speak. So denialism comes easy and is in fact welcomed among many. So this is why our conservation committee is so excited to partner with education. People need to know the facts. People need to know the truth about corporate and political drivers. And we are helpful that with, you know, increased education, increased knowledge concerning these topics, that citizens will be compelled to use their voices and actions to affect positive change. So another thing to bring up here is President Biden's, he signed an executive order, 14008, called Tackling the Climate Crisis at Home and Abroad. And this executive order basically is a call to action for certain administrative groups under his administration to find out how to restore 30% of our lands and our waters for the sake of the economy, our health, and our well-being, and of course, to combat climate change. So this is an exciting effort that we're hoping to continue to educate people on in terms of our conservation efforts as well, but also inform them on what they can do moving forward.
Oh, thank you, Angela. It's very exciting that UMP Watersheds now has a climate change website and a radio show that we're going to be doing at least twice a month, and that we're engaging with our partners, the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, the Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, and that we're learning. And that's the key thing about education and science. It isn't a question about just rotely following what people are saying, it's all about learning and understanding and what other people are doing and have done for years. So well over 99% of scientists agree that climate change is a real thing and that we need to be concerned about it. So what we look forward to in our programs and working with our coalitions is to educate people and to have a discussion about climate change. So let's talk a little more about why conserving mature and old growth forests should be a cornerstone effort in the goal to protect 30% of the lands and waters by 2020.
Sure. So I think first and foremost, it's a win-win for carbon and biodiversity. The United States is facing twin ecological crises here, climate change as well as biodiversity loss. In fact, some scientists even have gone on to warn that we are headed into and maybe even already in a mass extinction event. And so conserving biodiversity is paramount. So, you know, conserving mature and old growth forests are going to safeguard our critical carbon sinks on the landscape, while simultaneously protecting intact forest habitats for species to have and to hold on to and become resilient and be resilient as they adapt to the coming changes.
Yes, the goal to preserve 30% of lands and waters, including old growth, it directly addresses the impacts of climate change and protects communities. Communities and wildlife have faced unprecedented environmental challenges as the impacts of climate change have become more severe. We've seen drought, heat waves, flooding, extreme weather-driven fires.
That's absolutely right. And you know, we're talking here from Douglas County, but those wildfire events have been California, Oregon, even parts of Washington. And we already know the science has been out there for a long time, but it's evident that the mature and old growth forests are more resilient to these wildfire events. So in addition to storing carbon, they're also there to protect the habitats and to be more resilient to these wildfire events. But we need more connectivity of these forests as well for that to take place.
Another point is that mature and old growth forests prevent erosion and flooding. Intact forests have a positive effect on the redistribution of runoff. They stabilize water table levels and retain soil moisture. These processes help stabilize slopes, prevent water and wind erosion, and regulate the transport of nutrients and sediments.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Another point is that older forests protect our drinking water. You know, healthy forest watersheds, you know, they're going to protect both our water quality and quantity. And this is paramount as we move into, you know, the upcoming changes with climate change, because it's predicted that more drought events are going to plague us as well. So in the United States, our forests are, you know, the largest source of our drinking water. So protecting the older forests are going to serve this purpose well, to protect our drinking water quality and quantity.
Protecting mature and old growth forests helps save fish and wildlife. The habitat connectivity provided by large contiguous forest areas spanning environmental gradients such as latitude, altitude, rainfall, or temperature maximize the potential for key processes such as gene flow and genetic adaptation to play out while allowing species to track shifting climates.
And I know we already touched on this, but it's definitely worth mentioning again that our mature and old growth forests are better able to withstand and recover from the more frequent and severe wildfire events. So differences in fire regimes among ecoregions, you know, these need to be an important part of any decision-making process, as some forests are much less vulnerable to the impacts of climate change than other forests. You know, there have been studies that have shown that old growth forests burn much cooler than the younger forests, which were more likely to experience high severity fires. So this goes to, you know, the resilience factor of a forest. This is explained by thicker protective bark on bigger, older trees, and by higher multi-layer canopies, which keep temperatures cool and enable the forest to retain more moisture in the air and soil. So lots of reasons why we need to conserve and protect the mature and old forest for purposes of climate change mitigation and adaptation.
One final point, there is very little forest left in the United States, yet these forests are still under threat from logging. Our land management agencies should be working to shift their focus from measuring board feet harvested to recovering biodiversity and measuring metric tons of carbon dioxide sequestered and stored. This has a tremendous value on into future generations. And if you cut it now, if we get rid of our old growth, we won't get it back. We can't all of a sudden turn the clock up 200 or 300 years and have these trees back. They need to be here now. They've played a vital role for these forests for hundreds of years in many ways, as we've already discussed, and we need to protect old growth forests.
That's absolutely right. And I've said it before that, you can't take down an old growth forest and just simply replant it and expect the forest and ecosystem return. It doesn't work that way. We've got to protect and preserve what we have. So I'm excited that we're talking about this. And so here's a call to action here is that, the Department of Interior is working in coordination with the Department of Agriculture and Commerce, as well as the Council on Environmental Quality, to establish how the Biden administration is going to move forward with this 30-30 initiative. The comment period is open until March 4th, and just go to the Federal Register online. It'll be there. And basically the comment period right now is focused on what is called the American Conservation and Stewardship Atlas. This is going to be a tool whereby they can, and this is what they're asking for public comment on, is, you know, what data sources and standards and technical approaches need to be used and applied so that this is going to be an authoritative tool but very useful for the public. On the Federal Register portal, the agencies are asking for input on science and data. So what is needed in the Atlas to make sure that this is a useful tool for the public, but also how is the Atlas going to reflect the conservation work that is already underway? And third, outcomes. So they want to know how the Atlas can best reflect land and water contributions to biodiversity, climate change mitigation, and resilience. So there's lots of opportunity to comment on this and help the Biden administration put this together properly. So let your voices be heard, and together we'll make a difference here.
Yes, and I just want to remind everybody, Umpqua Watersheds is out in the Umpqua, in the forest on BLM land, in the forest on Forest Service land, looking at our old growth, looking at actions, working with our agencies to try to make sure that they're aware of what our concerns are.
Thanks so much, Angela and Ryan. Really appreciate all your insights. And this has been a great discussion on our first show focusing on climate change. Tune in next week when Viviana Young will continue the discussions on living downstream.
KQUA, The River.
Programming on KQUA is supported in part by Medicine Flower, specializing in flavors, aromatherapy supplies, natural remedies, and rocks and minerals from around the world. More information at genuineessentialoils.com.
Funding for Living Downstream was made possible in part by Riverside Mona Marie Vacation Rental, located on the North Umpqua River near Glide, Oregon. More information at 907-888-0460.